this week's 51%, hear about the gender effect in charitable initiatives.
We already know that girls and women bear the costs of poverty, so why are we also making them responsible for ending it?
Meet a woman who has learned to manage her chronic pain, and writer Dr. Jerry Byrne shares a fable. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. In recent years, a number of Fortune 500 companies have focused charitable initiatives on supporting and empowering girls and women living in poverty around the world. Programs like the Nike Foundation's Girl Effect have led the way, using media and mobile technologies to open up new opportunities for impoverished adolescent girls. Yet University of Wisconsin-Madison Educational Policy Studies professor Catherine Moeller argues that while these programs have some benefits, in many ways, they're actually working against their goals. In her new book, The Gender Effect, Capitalism, Feminism, and the Corporate Politics of Development, she probes the depth of these corporate initiatives, questioning their motives and effectiveness. 51%'s Jessica Blaustein Marshall recently spoke with Moeller about her book and what it takes to make a philanthropic program for elevating girls and women in poverty effective. Moeller starts by talking about the premise for her book.
So for more than a decade, corporations like Nike, Goldman Sachs, and ExxonMobil have been investing their philanthropic and corporate social responsibility funds in poor girls and women in Asia, Africa, and Latin America. And they've been doing so to generate what they call a ripple effect from the scale of girls and women's families to the scale of the nation and even the world. And the idea is that it reduces poverty, increases economic productivity, limits population growth, controls the spread of HIV/AIDS, and so on. And so this theory of social and economic change, which really comes out of economic studies, mostly out of the World Bank from the early 1990s, was then popularized by the Girl Effect campaign led by Nike and the Nike Foundation. And that was launched in 2008. And it's influenced programs for millions of girls around the world, including countries like Liberia, Bangladesh, and as well as Brazil, where I conducted my research. So in my book, I look at this phenomenon, and I essentially ask, how and why are companies investing in poor girls and women, and what are the effects for both girls and women, but also for these companies, many of which have ongoing public relations controversies that they're attempting to recover from.
Now, what led you personally to write this book?
So I was a high school teacher prior to returning to graduate school, as well as a feminist, and I was concerned about the young women in my classroom, as well as literature I was reading on girls and young women being out of school in disproportionate numbers. As I entered graduate school at the University of California, Berkeley, I was trying to map who were the institutional actors involved in girls' education, including non-governmental organizations, often known as NGOs, multilateral and bilateral agencies such as the World Bank, and then also governments. And as I was doing this in 2004 and 2005, I noticed that corporations had begun also to enter this new area of what is known as gender education and development. And in 2005, Nike and the Nike Foundation announced that the Nike Foundation was going to be entirely committed to investing in adolescent girls in countries in the global south. And I thought, wow, this is a new development actor, one that is not discussed in neither the literature or really known about in the field of gender and development. And so I began to think, what is the effect of these companies on investing in girls and women's education?
Why isn't this working? Why is it having a reverse effect on the people that they're trying to help?
Yeah, so in the book, I worked to challenge the common sense assumption about investing in girls and women globally as a silver bullet for solving all of our global ills. This includes everything from ending poverty to fighting global climate change. And I try to show how this approach that corporations have adopted actually shifts the burden of global change onto poor girls and women in the global south. It actually disproportionately makes them responsible for problems that they didn't create without actually addressing the real causes of poverty and inequality. So while solving these problems is really important, this approach, I argue, is actually ineffective as well as morally wrong. So don't get me wrong, I strongly believe that girls and women are powerful experts on their lives and on our world, but by transferring the burden of ending poverty onto them, it actually leaves the root causes of poverty intact. And then it also transfers the responsibility for change away from governments, corporations, as well as global governance institutions, who are often responsible for many of the structural conditions that cause poverty. Yeah, and then my second point, that it's morally wrong. We already know that girls and women bear the costs of poverty, so why are we also making them responsible for ending it? As the director of an NGO funded by the Nike Foundation in Brazil once explained to me, she said, sometimes I think we're asking too much of these young women, as she considered what was asked of the poor black and brown young women enrolled in her program. So I think we need to think about why we don't ask this of boys and men, much less white middle class and wealthy girls and women, if we really think about this moment of both Black Lives Matter as well as the kind of Me Too Time's Up moment. Isn't that sexist, not to mention classist and racist?
Now, you talked too about the theory of social and economic change as kind of a model for these companies' philanthropic efforts. Why are they doing it this way?
So in my book, I talk about companies investing in girls and women as a result of what I call the reactionary and then the expansionary tendencies of corporate capitalism. So on one hand, companies are really trying to mitigate public relations problems. Companies often begin programs to invest in poor girls and women while they're recovering from public relations problems. So we can think about Nike's sweatshop woes, legal claims against ExxonMobil for environmental and human rights abuses, the series of class action lawsuits against Walmart for gender discrimination. These companies all have histories of significant controversy over business practices frequently involving female workers. But then on the other hand, these companies are also investing in poor girls and women as a new frontier for economic growth in countries or in regions where they may or may not be currently operating. So this is part of the kind of long-term need for companies to ensure future growth by generating new consumers, laborers, and producers.
Can we drill down a little bit into those individual programs and communities? You talk about a more holistic approach to designing programs for these women. Can you talk about that?
Through my fieldwork in Brazil, I spent time at two non-governmental organizations. And in the book, I try to show how this corporate approach really leads to narrow forms of education, forms of education that the executives creating these programs would actually never design for their children. So on one hand, I found that there's a focus on pushing back the age of pregnancy and marriage for girls and young women. This is part of the equation that Nike and others have put forward, is that you need to push back pregnancy in order to be able to promote economic growth. And from a human rights perspective, we know that this is really problematic given the long history of control, especially over black and brown girls, women, and women's reproductive lives in the U.S. and globally. And then on the other hand, what I found is that programs really have a disproportionate emphasis on what they call economic empowerment, really trying to connect girls and women with economic assets. And what this translated into for the program I observed was that there was a really focus on entrepreneurial education and training to be administrative assistants. And one, I think, particularly poignant moment was at the very beginning of the program. I was excited as an educator and a feminist when all the young women went around the room to say what they wanted to be. It was the first day of the program. And they had desires to be pharmacists and veterinarians and doctors. And then 6 months later, at the end of the program, these same young women went around the room and they said almost all of them wanted to be administrative assistants. It was so striking that a former Nike Foundation employee who was visiting actually turned to me and asked why they were all interested in becoming administrative assistants. So what I saw here was that rather than an education that's more holistic and transformative, that the program actually was narrowing their future possibilities and imaginations of what they could be.
Now, how can we get this right? How can these companies get it right if they really have their hearts in the right places?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I think if companies genuinely want to serve girls and women, which I think many of the individuals in these companies and in their foundations really do, then I think companies need to first clean up their business practices, both at home in the U.S. as well as abroad, that put girls and women at risk. So this includes ensuring safe worker conditions, paying equitable living wages, allowing their workers and their supply chains, even if they're in contract factories, to organize, providing health insurance, fortifying public systems by paying proper taxes in countries not only where they're headquartered but where they operate around the world, as well as, you know, this Me Too moment is really illuminated. We need to eliminate gender discrimination and sexual violence in the workplace in the U.S. and more broadly.
That was University of Wisconsin-Madison professor Catherine Moeller speaking with 51%'s Jessica Blaustein Marshall. Moeller's book is entitled The Gender Effect, Capitalism, Feminism, and the Corporate Politics of Development. Fall off your bike, get a few scratches, reach for a Band-Aid. You have a headache? Well, take an ibuprofen. But what happens when the pain is constant with no quick fix? Rachel Ishikawa brings us the story of a woman from Massachusetts who's had to be creative managing her chronic pain.
Terry Michon doesn't take the back seat anymore. She used to ride behind her partner, but this year at age 55, she got her own motorcycle permit. She has a cruiser. It's a Honda Shadow. It's brand new, pewter gray, and sparkly.
I haven't named her yet. I guess for today's discussion, we'll just call her the painkiller, you know.
Painkiller. That's what she's calling her motorcycle. Terry has fibromyalgia. It's a chronic disorder that causes pain throughout the body. But you wouldn't know that by looking at her. She's tall and looks strong.
It's just really painful, like stabbing in your legs. But you can't see that. And if you're going on about with a smile on your face, like most of us with pain are trying to do, you can't see that it might be torture going up that stair or down the stairs because we're trying to fake it.
And there's one other thing.
Gosh, what's the word I'm looking for? Anyway, fibrofog.
Fibrofog. That's a cognitive difficulty affecting focus and memory. It's another symptom of fibromyalgia.
That's probably one of the, you know, the big things because, like, sometimes I can't take a thought and connect it back to where I was.
You can see traces of Terry's chronic pain all through her house. In the bedroom, there's a massage table for Reiki. In the living room, there's a foot massager and a bag of Epsom salts. And there's a painting. It's hanging by the front door. It's of a mermaid clinging onto a rope as seaweed is pulling her back.
That's what that painting kind of represents to me, is always that struggle of trying to get out, but always being, like, held down.
Before her pain, Terry says she was in great shape. She was kayaking down the Bass River and rode her bike along the canal. But that all changed about 12 years ago after several surgeries and a divorce.
Along with the divorce, that emotional strain, I think that compounded, like, what I was going through, like, with physical things. That's when the chronic pain and the fibromyalgia started.
Infections and physical or emotional trauma probably contribute to chronic pain. But there still isn't a cure. Doctors usually recommend a combination of self-care and antidepressants or pain relievers.
I've been put on the fentanyl patch, which I did not know fentanyl was, like, as bad as heroin or worse. I quit. I got off of that patch. It was a nightmare. And that's why I don't support opioids as a long-term answer to pain.
So Terry's found other ways to ease her fibromyalgia. She's painting again after almost 20 years. That mermaid painting by her front door, that's an original. She's working on a new painting now.
I'm just kind of layering on one of these strokes of the red, and red's kind of symbolic of life and action.
Terry's painting a woman with red hair like her own. Rainbow stripes stretch across the woman's body, but only her head is visible.
I've used my mind more to overcome the pain than probably anything else, and finding things that bring you joy. And I look for joy in everything in my life. Things like riding the motorcycle, you know, those are like painkillers to me. Anything that can make you happy. And that includes your art, photography, you know, whatever it is, it brings you joy. Because I'm not going to let pain steal another minute of my life.
Terry takes the motorcycle out most days now. She says riding distracts her from the pain. And then, as she says, there's the wind and the freedom. The same goes for painting. If she's immersed in her work, then the pain is secondary. It's a power play. Terry can top her pain if she just stays present.
I lost a lot of joy over those years, and now I'm collecting joy. I'm trying to fill my joy baskets.
Terry's sitting on the couch with two pillows supporting her back. She's looking at her painting of the mermaid.
Maybe one day I'll paint my mermaid out of the water. I might just do that one day, is just paint her like swimming free.
For WCAI's Ways of Life, I'm Rachel Ishikawa in North Falmouth.
This piece was produced for WCAI's Ways of Life series during a Transom Story workshop. Ephra Mansour has an exhibit at the Minneapolis Institute of Art. It's called I Am Somali. KFAI's Dixie Trichel produced this audio portrait.
I think for those of us immigrants that are removed from our countries, that are also removed from our heritage and our history, it becomes more and more difficult for us to find positive ways for us to learn about our culture, our history. My name is Ephra Mansour. I am a multimedia performance artist in Minneapolis, Minnesota. I love to do art in as many forms as possible. There's so many ways to tell a story. I was born in Saudi Arabia, and then my family moved back to Somalia. That is when the 1991 civil war broke out. My family had then fled to the Dadaab refugee camp, and we eventually got sponsored to come to America. All of those big moments happened before I was the age of 10. I'm trying to create work where kids that don't know anything about their heritage could feel comfortable, welcomed to learn something unique about their culture, inspires them to learn more about their culture. I Am Somali at Minneapolis Institute of Art until May 27th of 2018 is the first Somali art exhibit. I'm also extra blessed to be the first Somali female artist to be exhibited. I've got a piece called Can I Touch It? It is a film fabric sculpture installation. The piece is about hair, hijab, politics. It is about the microaggressions and everyday struggles that Muslim black women that wear their natural beautiful hair out go through in stopping the world from engaging them in a intrusive, harassing way.
That was artist Ephra Mansour speaking about her exhibit, I Am Somali. And now writer Dr. Jerry Burns brings us a fable.
It probably won't shock you when I say that we live in challenging, divisive times. People are quick to judge these days, quick to speak, dismiss, and disparage one another. While people in our country have trouble coming to consensus about many things, I think most of us can agree on one thing. In general, people nowadays don't expect the best out of others. And that, I think, diminishes the best in us. Like other performing artists I know, I strive to bring artistic material to audiences to help heal this divide, to bridge differences, and remind myself and others that we are all members of the same humanity. And so one day, while I was on the treadmill, I had a thought. It is traditional in many cultures to use fables to help children grow up. Legend also suggests that fables have been used to train kings in statecraft. Because fables are more likely to be about animals than people, they provide metaphorical images of behaviors to emulate or avoid, rather than confront people directly. I thought, why not meander through an Aesop's fable compendium to look for a story that speaks to the times we live in? All I had to do was read one story. See, there was something on my social media news feed that day about someone who erroneously jumped to a conclusion about someone else, causing upset and friction. That first story was already relevant. Here is my retelling of that little animal fable, one that I hope can help us all live easier with each other in these tumultuous days. Once, an ant was busy bustling around the forest floor searching for food. His little legs tapped the leaves as he walked, making a pleasant purr to accompany him on his forage. He scurried this way and that until he came upon something he'd never seen before. Hanging on a tiny branch of a leafy bush was a hard green object, like a shell or a holiday ornament. He didn't know what to make of it. He stared at it for a while, trying to work out what it was. Then he climbed to the bush and explored it from up close. He tapped it with his tiny legs like he was knocking on a door. But nothing happened. No one answered. Just as the ant was about to climb down to the ground, the shell moved. It was a tiny, gentle side-to-side motion at the very bottom. The object was not empty. It was a chrysalis. "Ho, ho," cried the ant, "you are alive indeed." Then the ant proceeded to babble on to the chrysalis, asking it questions. "So, what is your name? What do you do? What kind of animal are you? How long have you lived here? What's up?" But the chrysalis's only response was that same back-and-forth movement, as if it were an old dog, tiredly wagging its tail. The ant shook its own little head. "Well, aren't you the saddest little thing I've ever seen in my life? There you are, inside a shell, living out your life, locked inside a prison." The ant ran back and forth along the branch. "Look at me. My life is the one to have. I can run and dance. I can climb up and down trees." And so saying, the little ant scurried back down to the earth. "I can forage in the woods and run across leaves. I can gaze at the sun in the sky or make tunnels underground." The ant looked up at the chrysalis one more time and muttered, "And just what do you do?" "Sit in a box. I feel so sorry for you." Then he went away and forgot all about it. But almost a week later, on a bright and sunny day, the ant found himself back in that part of the woods again. Standing under the same bush, he saw the green shell, but now it was cracked open. Suddenly, the shell was darkened by a huge shadow. The moment was brief, and then the shadow moved away like a big cloud blocking the sun. But then the shadow returned, and then it disappeared a few more times. Back and forth, clouds don't do that, the ant thought. He got scared and looked up. And there, sitting on a higher branch on that same bush, was a big and beautiful butterfly stretching and folding its wings. It called down to the ant, "You thought my life was worth nothing more than the dead leaves under your feet, but now you know who I really am. You were wrong about me. You see, I don't move like you. I move like me. You nibble on foods. I sip nectar. You climb trees. I fly up into their branches. You tunnel under the ground, and I soar overhead." The butterfly flew up into the sky, then softly landed on the branch just above the ant's head. "We are not exactly alike, but still we both can gaze at the sky." Then the ant climbed up the bush and joined the butterfly on the branch. They sat there together for quite some time, gazing at the sky and listening to each other. You see, fables are not just for children.
Dr. Jerry Burns is a storyteller, writer, and educator living in New York's Hudson Valley. You can find her at storycrafters.com. She also is an adjunct professor in the Department of Communication at the State University of New York at New Paltz. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1496.